May 11th, 1962, Lecture 46, Ratchet and Paul. May 11th, 1962, Lecture 46, Ratchet and Paul. May 11th, 1962, Lecture 46, Ratchet and Paul.
Today I want to talk about the ratchet and Paul, which is a very simple device which is made so that it can turn only one way. The possibility of having something turn only one way, it turns out, requires some more detailed and careful analysis. And there are very interesting consequences of the fact that a device can turn only one way, and that's the purpose of the present lecture. The plan of the lecture began when I was trying to find an elementary explanation from the molecular or kinetic point of view for the fact that there's a maximum amount of work that can be extracted when there's a given temperature difference and a certain amount of heat passes from one place to another. Of course, we have Carnot's demonstration by pure thermodynamics argument, but it would be I have been trying in all these lectures to find an explanation, although it may be somewhat difficult to follow the reasoning. At least the reasoning is elementary in a sense. It doesn't involve some kind of mathematics that you haven't studied and so on. Now, I know complicated mathematical demonstrations from the mechanical theory of Newton's laws to demonstrate that it's also true, that if you have two different temperatures, you can't get any more work out than so and so much when you have a given amount of heat that flows from one to the other. But I had great difficulty in converting that to an elementary demonstration. In other words, in short, I didn't understand it, although I could follow the mathematics. So in attempting to do this, I turned back a little bit further, and then I found my way out. You see, in Carnot's argument, the fact that more than a certain amount of work cannot be extracted in going from one temperature to another is deduced from another axiom, which is that if you have everything at the same temperature, and the reverse of no fundamental change, a cyclic phenomenon, so everything is brought back, the heat cannot be converted to work. It seemed to me then, if I paid attention to that proposition and saw why that was impossible, then I might get a clue of why the other was, because obviously one is a consequence of the other. So I backed up, and the moment I did that, I saw my way to at least not a complete and general explanation, but at least an explanation that's elementary enough in a specific example, and that example involves my ratchet and Paul. And so I invent, as you may have already invented, a device to violate the second law. That is, a gadget which will take heat out of this reservoir. Here, let's say there's a gas here with vanes inside on a wheel, on an axle, and this is at a certain temperature. The whole thing is at a certain temperature. And because of the bombardments on the vane of the gas molecules, the vane oscillates and jiggles according to the Brownian motion. And all we have to do, you see, is to hook onto the other end of this a wheel which can only turn one way, the ratchet and Paul, say. And then this thing will perpetuate. When it jiggles this way, it won't turn, and when it jiggles that way, it will turn, and so the wheel will slowly turn. And perhaps you might even put a flea on it and lift the flea. I mean, there may be some power available from the system. And so we have to consider whether this is possible. According to Carnot's hypothesis, it's impossible. But if you just look at it, you see prima facie that it's absolutely possible. So we must look more closely. First, if you look at the ratchet and Paul, there are a number of complications. I made an idealized ratchet as simple as possible. But even as simple as possible, it has this thing, the Paul, and it has a spring on the Paul. What's the spring for? Because if the ratchet were to turn and to lift off a tooth, then the Paul has to come back or the ratchet won't work. So I have to push the Paul back again. So that's what the spring is for. Now we see how it works. It goes this way, it lifts the Paul, and the spring pushes it back. There's still another feature in this ratchet and Paul which is not drawn but is very essential, and that is this. Suppose that everything that was drawn here were made of perfectly elastic parts. Then after the Paul was lifted off the end of the tooth and it fell back as a consequence of the effect of the spring, it would bounce against the wheel and continue to bounce, and thus when there were another fluctuation came, the wheel could turn the other way because the tooth can get underneath during the moment in which the pawl is bouncing up and down. Therefore, an essential part of the irreversibility of our wheel is a damping or deadening mechanism, which permits the spring to bring the thing back and stop the motion. Now, when that happens, of course, the energy that was in the pawl has gone into the wheel, and it shakes the whole wheel in actual practice. But if we make this wheel of idealized parts, it will bounce forever and not work. Or if it's not of idealized parts, each time the thing turns, it will put some heat into the wheel, because as it falls down, the energy that was in the pawl when it was off the top of the tooth will be generated inside the wheel. And so the wheel will get hotter and hotter and hotter. In order to make the thing simpler so it's not just the wheel, we can put a gas in here to take some of the temperature off the wheel. Anyway, ultimately, let's say the gas keeps rising in temperature along with the wheel, and this gets to a certain temperature. Will it go on forever? No. Because there comes a time when the Brownian motion of the pawl, due to the fact that it's touching a piece of metal which is shaking, because everything is at temperature T, when the Brownian motion of the pawl is such that every once in a while, by accident, it lifts itself up. I mean, it gets lifted up by the Brownian motion, lifts itself over a tooth just at the moment when the Brownian motion from this end is trying to push the other way. And so you see what can happen. The reason that this device doesn't work as perpetual motion is this, that although at first you forgot about the fact that you have to have an energy loss here, when you take it into account that when this reaches the same temperature as this, the following events occur. First, when we turn this sometimes, and it lifts the pawl up and goes over the end. But sometimes when it's turning the other way, the pawl is already lifted up due to the fluctuations and irregularities of the motions on the other side, and the thing goes back the other way, the net result being nothing. And so it is not hard to demonstrate that, in fact, when the temperatures are equal, there'll be no net average motion of the wheel. Of course, the wheel will do a lot of this way and a lot of that way, but it won't do what we want, which is to turn one way. Let me show you the reason. In order to get this thing to turn, unfortunately, because of the spring, but the spring was necessary, it is necessary to do some work against the spring in order to lift the pawl off the top of the tooth. In other words, if we take zero energy for the pawl to correspond to the position that the pawl is at the bottom of the tooth, then as the wheel starts to turn and the pawl comes ultimately to the top of the tooth, there's a difference in energy of the pawl because it's done work against its spring. Let me call epsilon the energy needed to lift the pawl over the hot top of the tooth. And just a moment, we'll use another thing. Let theta be the angle between the teeth for later purposes. So that defines all my letters now. Epsilon is the energy that you need to put up into the spring in order to lift it over the top of the tooth, and theta is the angle you'd move through if you moved one tooth distance. All right, now what happens is this, that the chance that this thing can accumulate enough energy, epsilon, in order to get over the top of the tooth is, of course, e to the minus epsilon over kt. That's the odds that it'll make it by going around this way. On the other hand, to go the other way, it can't do it at all as long as the pawl is down there. But the probability that the pawl will accidentally be up, which means energy epsilon over its normal zero, over the low position, even though the wheel is in this position, the chance that the pawl is fluctuated up is also e to the minus energy over kt, is the same energy needed to lift against the spring. And so that the number of times, so to speak, the pawl is up and the wheel can turn this way freely is equal to the number of times when the pawl is down and you need to get the energy epsilon to turn it with the other side. So you see that we get a balance and the wheel will not go around. On the other hand, we can now go further with this thing. Suppose that this were cold, the wheel, then certainly it'll work. So let's take the example where this temperature, the temperature of the vane is T1, and the temperature of the wheel, the ratchet, is T2, and T2, we'll suppose, is less than T1, for instance, and then, of course, because this is cold and the fluctuations of the pawl are relatively infrequent, it will be very hard for the pawl to get up the energy epsilon, And this thing will easily, because of the high temperature, get up the energy epsilon, so it'll much more go, it'll go in one direction, there's no question of that. We'd now like to see how it can lift weights if the temperature is different. So we put onto this drum a string, let's say we tie it here, and hang it down here with a weight at the end. And let's suppose that it's a unit radius or something, and that L is the torque, or load torque, on the wheel due to the weightlifting. You know, we're going to do work on the weight, you see. And now our machine, if L is not too great, will lift the weight because the Brownian fluctuations make it move more likely this way than the other way. And we want to find, first of all, how much weight it can lift and how fast it goes around and so on. And that's what we're going to analyze now in more detail. Remember that the temperatures are unequal. So first, we consider a forward motion. That means the usual way you design a ratchet. That's what I mean by forward. In order to make a forward motion, how much energy has to be borrowed from here? It must be the energy to lift the pole. So we must borrow from the vane, an energy epsilon to lift the pole. But wait, because the thing turns to an angle theta, and we're lifting the weight also, we have to be doubly strong. We have to borrow more energy. We have to also borrow the energy, the torque, times the angle through which the tooth has to turn also, so that the total amount of energy that we have to borrow is this. I see you're all taking notes and everything. It's all right if you want. But you can have more fun. Just sit here and listen to me if you want. It's up to you. So we have to borrow this from the vane, and the probability that we get this is relatively e to the minus the energy over kt, 1. And the number of times it'll go over a tooth, then, is somehow proportional to this. Actually, if you think about it a while, it isn't only a question of getting the energy. You have to put a time in order to get the number per second, the time, so to speak, to slip off the end of the vein. At any rate, the probability per second is proportional to this, and I'll just call tau a 1 over a time as a constant of proportionality. If you want to be much more definite, I thought it out very carefully by putting steps in the ratchet, and it has to climb up the various steps, and then tau is the chance that it falls off the top step per second when it's up there. How long does it take to fall off? But it doesn't make any difference. It's some constant. The constant will cancel out in the end. Now, I would like to remark that when this happens, when a forward motion happens, the work done on the weight is, of course, L theta, because the weight is lifted. The energy taken from the vane, which I'll call a T1 bath, or whatever you want to call it, is, of course, epsilon plus L theta. But I also point out that energy is delivered to the ratchet system, or to the T2 thing, because after it has lifted the pole up and the pole then falls down its epsilon, the spring which was wound up with energy epsilon, then it goes clatter, clatter, bang, bang, vroom, vroom, heats up this side by energy epsilon. Therefore, the energy delivered to the section here is epsilon, and it checks all right because of the conservation of energy. All the energy taken out goes to lift the weight and to drive the pole, which then falls back and gives heat to the other one. Now we take the opposite. We have the opposite case. We have backward motion. Now what happens there? Here we have to borrow from the ratchet system, from the pole system, or the gas where the pole is, or however you want to say it, an energy epsilon. All you need in order to get it to go backwards is to lift this thing enough energy against the spring, so it'll slip. And the probability for that per second is, again, the same constant that, if you figure it out carefully, it turns out, times e to the minus the energy, only this time over kT2, because that's a different temperature, and the chance that the pole is able to get up energy epsilon is e to the minus energy over kT2. Now, when this happens, the work is released. There's a release of work because the thing slips backward. It loses one notch. And so it releases a work L theta. The energy taken from the ratchet system is epsilon, and the energy given to the gas in T1, to the vane, is L theta plus epsilon. Now, it takes a little thinking to see the reason for that. If the pole has lifted itself up accidentally by a fluctuation, then when it falls back and a spring pushes it down against the tooth, as in this picture, there is a force driving the tooth back because you're pushing down on an inclined plane. And so you do work by this. It's this doing work, it's pushing, and this, the weight, is also pulling the other way because it's slipping. So both together makes the total force and stuff which is working on here higher than L theta, and all the energy of the release, the slow release of the pole energy and the release of the weight energy, all appears in the vane. Of course, it has to by conservation of energy, but one must be careful to think the thing through. Now you'll notice, since I was careful, all these energies are exactly the same and reversed. The sign is always reversed. It's given to the vane or it's taken from the vane. So depending upon which of these two rates are greater, we have two possibilities. Either the weight is slowly lifted or the weight is slowly released. On average, of course, it's jiggling around, going up for a while, going down for a while. But on the average, the weight is slowly released or slowly lifted, depending upon which of these two rates are greater. Suppose that for a certain particular weight, the rates happen to be equal. Then it's this way. If I put an infinitesimal weight there, it'll slowly go down. Work will be done by the machine as time goes on, very slowly. Energy will be taken out of this and put in here. If I then take that weight off and a little bit more, just a shade more, then the imbalance is the other way. The rate of this is higher than that. The wheel turns the opposite way around. Work is done, and heat is taken out of here and put into here. So we have the conditions of Carnot's business of a reversible cycle, provided we're in a reversible condition, provided that the weight is just so that these two rates are equal. So the condition for reversibility, or almost at the edge of working, is that the two rates are equal, which is evidently that epsilon plus L theta is to T1. This is epsilon is to T2. But when it works in either direction, let's say that works in the way of lifting the weight, then it takes an energy out of here and delivers an energy into there, which are in the proportion of epsilon plus L theta to epsilon. That is to say, if it runs for a certain amount of time, the total energy taken would be W. Total energy taken out of here, we can call Q1. And the total energy delivered to there, we can call Q2. If it runs the opposite way, then these dominate, but they're in the same proportion. So if it runs for a while, W is to Q1 is to Q2, as L theta is to epsilon plus L theta is to epsilon. They're all in the same proportion, of course, because in each step, that's the proportion. So in any number of steps, that's the proportion. Therefore, you see that since epsilon plus L theta is to epsilon, as T1 is to T2, so also Q1 is to Q2 as T1 is to T2. In other words, where the equilibrium condition is set in and then the thing runs one way or the other, then the total amount of heat which is borrowed from one is partly delivered to work and remainder goes into the other thing, and the remainder fraction is in the proportion of the ratio of the two temperatures. And so we understand now the machinery behind the arguments of Carnot, because we see that when we've got the thing so that it can be run either way by an infinitesimal force and it's balanced, then more energy is taken out of T1 than is put into T2. And the reason fundamentally is something like this, it seems to me, that when the temperature is high, it's very easy to get strong jiggling motions, and it would easily undo the poor guy on the other side who has a low temper and is trying to oppose it. And if the weight weren't there, of course, it would roaring run of energy would go from one to the other. It would turn the pole around, and the pole would go snap, 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 hot, hot, heat, heat, all the time. But by putting on the weight, we work against the high energy, and we give an advantage to the low energy, but in the process, What we've done essentially is to take it away from the energy that's available here per KT, so to speak, the KT. We've taken away enough that it can balance the other guy's KT. And so the ratio of the energies delivered here and put back here are proportional to the temperatures, because KT is the average energy of fluctuation. And to make the balance, we take we get a fluctuation strength KT1 per second, so to speak, and here KT2, and we have to take away the difference. That, of course, is a sloppy description of something which is much more carefully analyzed here. Needless to say, by subtracting and so forth, since this is obvious that the W is Q1 minus Q2 and so on, so that all the other conclusions about the efficiency of the engines and so forth works here. And so we have a very simple mechanical engine that we can neatly understand. I would just stop here just a moment for those who are interested in such devices that work one way, to calculate, as long as we have everything set up here, what the rate would be if everything were at the same temperature and we put a weight on it. You see, how good is the ratchet? Suppose you have the ratchet at a given temperature and you pull on it. It goes around this way easier, doesn't it, than it goes around the other way, even at a finite temperature, if you pull on it. Now, we're not using it to make any thermodynamics. It's out of equilibrium now. We would like to study the case when the whole thing is at the same temperature. We have a ratchet and pull at temperature T. And we pull on it. We want to know how fast does it go around. If we pull very, very hard, of course, it goes all kinds of complications. You throw the pawl off, the spring breaks on. But I mean, if we're pulling not too fast and everything works nicely, then under those circumstances, this analysis is right for the probability of going forward and the probability of going backward, but the two temperatures are equal. But this time, I'm not going to adjust L so that it's just in equilibrium. I'm out of equilibrium. I'm asking how fast does it go around. So we might as well find out while we're at it, and it's very easy. Since the angle theta that's obtained every second, since in every one of these forwards and backwards, since in each step an angle theta is obtained, the angular velocity, or angle acquired per second, that's what angular velocity is theta times the probability of one of these things per second, and is then forwards with this probability, and backwards with this probability, with the same temperature, which is equal to a certain. These things do not depend upon the L, and when we get an e to the minus L of theta, I got some sign. Well, never mind the sign. We plot the negative of the angular velocity against minus L. And we get a curve that looks like this. Because I should have left the signs the way they are, I suppose. It's turned upside down. But for large L, I'm sorry about the signs. If you study this curve, you see that it makes quite a bit difference whether L is positive or negative. If L is negative, it's minus 1 on some scale. If L is positive, it's minus 1. If L is negative, then e to the plus a tremendous amount is a very great amount. So that's why this, I'll draw it better this way. At any rate, the angular velocity that was obtained from different forces is very unsymmetrical. This is like electrical rectifier, for example, in which instead of the force, we have the electric field on it. And instead of the angular velocity, we have the electric current. And so we have a different law. It's not a straight line. It's not that the voltage is a proportional resistance, but it's unsymmetrical. For going one way is easy. You get a lot of angular velocity for a little force. Going the other way, you can put a lot of force on it. It hardly goes around. So this is a rectifier. And the same analyses that I made for this mechanical rectifier, and it works also for electrical rectifiers, so don't come tomorrow to me quickly showing me a resistance here, a battery here, and then a little rectifier and say I got perpetual motion, because the rectifier of real rectifier works in exactly analogous manner. And in fact, this kind of a formula is typical of the current carrying capacities of rectifiers as a function of their voltage, because the machinery is the same, exactly in principle the same. But I won't deal much with the unequilibrium case anymore. I'll go back to discussing this thing in somewhat more detail. I would like to remark on a number of points. In the first place, let's take the weights away now and note the original idea. that if T2 were less than T1, if T2 were zero, the ratchet goes forward. Anybody would believe that. But what you would not at first sight believe if you hadn't stopped and thought about all this is the opposite. If you build a ratchet like this and have this side higher than this side, the ratchet goes around the opposite way. It has its own tendency to reverse itself. A dynamic ratchet with lots of heat in it runs itself backwards if it had a cold place to pour the, a place with a smooth resistance and no fluctuations. Because this ratchet head, this ratchet pour is going bounce, bounce, bounce. If it for a moment is on the incline somewhere and it comes down on the incline plane, it pushes the incline plane sideways. But it's always pushing on an incline plane, because if it happens to lift up high enough to get past the point and the incline plane slides by, it comes down again on an incline plane. So you see that this device, if you think about it the other way around, in which you think of this thing carefully built and that the point is that all the parts are perfectly elastic and that this is bouncing all the time, then you see this is ideally built to go around this way, which is the exact opposite of the way it was originally designed. So if the temperature in here is higher than this, it'll turn one way, and if the temperature in here is higher than that, it'll turn the other way. And in spite of all our cleverness of lopsided design, with notches that are one way and everything, if the two temperatures are exactly equal, there is no more propensity to turn this way, in spite of the way you thought it should, or that way. But on the average, it turns, so to speak, both ways. Any moment you look at it, maybe turning one way, maybe turning the other way. And in the long run, it gets nowhere. Why does it get nowhere? When everything is at the same temperature, the fact that it gets nowhere and that it's no more likely to turn to the right than to the left in spite of the design is really the fundamental deep principle on which the problems of thermal equilibrium and all this whole thermodynamics relies. What mechanical principle is it deeper in the works, of which this is only an example, which tells us that in the long run, that if the whole temperature is kept the same everywhere, the thing will neither turn to the right nor to the left? Let me change the question just a shade. Never mind keeping the temperature the same everywhere. Just keep the objects finite that you've got here. Just finite, a limited thing, so and so many molecules. And have this hot and this cold, I don't care. Have this hot. Then the Brownian motion works and the thing goes bing, bing, and the pawl hammers against the wheel and the energy is being delivered and this wheel heats up and so on. And if you wait long enough, please, long enough, then the temperatures get equal, and after a tremendous amount of time, perhaps, depending on how it was set up, it ultimately will be turning the same amount each way. So we have a fundamental proposition, this. If we can understand why, from mechanics, the laws of mechanics, that if you wait long enough, there's no way to design a machine which will be found to be more likely turning one way than the other. And I'll show you why that is. It's because the laws of mechanics run something like this, that the second derivative, I just outline it, not actually, it's got many dimensions, there are many particles and so on, but you get something like this, that the mass times the acceleration is the forces. And the forces, let's take the case as, for example, gravitation. There's some complicated function of the positions of all the other particles. There are other situations where the forces depend on the velocity, such as in magnetism and so on, but let me not consider that. It would take a simpler case first, like in gravity, where the forces just depend upon the position. Now, suppose that I have solved this, and I have a certain motion, x of t, on all the other particles moving around a certain way. In a complicated enough system, those solutions are very complicated. And what happens with time in a completely, in a very complicated system, turns out to be something like this. That if you'll work out any solution at all of these things, you'll find that solution happening after you wait long enough. Things to start to, it tries, if you kept this solution going for long enough, it, so to speak, tries everything that it can do. It isn't absolutely necessary in the simplest devices, but when they get complicated enough with enough atoms and stuff to get things out of balance and so on, it just gets into a complicated motion and it tries almost everything that it can do. Now there is something else it can do. If I've already solved this equation and have certain particular functions like t cubed plus t and so on, plus t squared, I claim that another solution would be minus t cubed minus t plus t squared also. That if you will substitute minus t everywhere for t throughout the entire motion, you will again get a solution of the same equations. The reason is because if you substitute minus t for t in the original differential equation, since it's the second derivative with respect to t, it still is the same. And so the backwards motion, a motion which has the development with time reversed, if you don't want to put minus t, you can put some absolute time minus t. It's the same thing, because if you do that, the equation is still reversed. That means that if you have a certain motion doing something as a possible motion, then the exact opposite motion is also possible. And then the complete confusion which comes if you wait long enough, it finds itself doing this sometimes, and it finds itself doing that sometimes, and nothing more beautiful about one of the motions than the other. And so in the long run, it is impossible to design a machine which is more likely to be going one way in the long run than any other way, if the machine is sufficiently complicated. You say to me, that's ridiculous. You take a single wheel and spin it in empty space and leave it alone, and you wait no matter how long, and it'll be always going the same way. There are some conditions like the conservations of angular momentum and so on, which violates this argument, and it requires a little more subtlety. But if a system is complicated enough and doesn't have any special conservation laws because the walls take up the angular momentum or something like that, then the argument can be made more rigorous. At any rate, that's qualitatively the reason. It's based on the fact that the laws of mechanics are reversible. Incidentally, for sort of historical interest, I'd like to remark on a device invented by Maxwell, who first worked out the dynamical theory of gases. He says, suppose that we have a little hole here in the gas between, there's a gas here all at the same temperature, and sits here an object, a demon, Maxwell's demon, which may be a machine, of course, but the idea is there's some kind of demon which watches the molecules that are coming from the right, from the left, I guess, okay. He watches the molecules that are coming from the left, and he has a little door at that hole, which he can open and close. Whenever he sees a fast molecule, he opens the door. When he sees a slow one, he leaves it closed. And if you want to be extra special, you can have eyes on the other side of his head and do the opposite on the molecules coming from the other side. But never mind, the opposite, you see. You let the slow ones through this way, and the fast ones through that way. Well, pretty soon, the heat will develop in here and remove over here. And Maxwell might argue, first, that the ideas of thermodynamics are impossible. You can't get thermal equilibrium fundamentally because you could have such a demon, but can you? One argument is say, well, that demon could be me. I could watch the thing, but I'm pretty big. It turns out if you build a finite-sized demon, that the demon gets warm enough that he can't see very well anymore. Because that's the demon. The ratchet is the demon. You see, the simplest possible demon, as an example, would be a gadget which has a doorway, a trap door with a spring. And when a fast molecule comes through, it is able to lift the trap door and come through. And when a slow molecule, never mind the other direction, the slow can't get through, bounces back. But this thing is nothing but our ratchet and pawl in another form. And ultimately, the thing will heat up. And it does turn out this way. That if you assume that the specific heat of the demon is not infinite, it hasn't got an infinite number of internal gears and wheels, so it can't get rid of the extra heat that it gets from observing the molecule, then pretty soon it's shaking from Brownian motion so much it can't tell whether it's coming or going, much less whether the molecules are coming or going, and so that doesn't work. And again, it's all on account of the principle that the laws of mechanics are reversible. Now, are all the laws of physics reversible? Evidently not. Are all the phenomena of physics reversible? Obviously not. If I show you a moving picture of the world, it only takes you a few minutes to start laughing if I have put it into the projector so that it runs from the wrong end of true. Because if someone's frying an egg, you see, you drop the egg into the pan and the egg solidifies, so you have this guy shaking the pan, then the egg liquefies and comes up into the shell, and the shell goes back together again. Obviously ridiculous. So it's evident again and again. The fact is that you know what I said after I said it, not before. At least some of you do. Some of the brilliant ones know beforehand what I'm going to say. Most of you only know after what I said. And so there are the thousands and thousands of examples. In fact, the most natural characteristic of all phenomena is this obvious irreversibility. Where does it come from? It doesn't come from Newton's laws. Are we made out of Newton's laws, or does it come from something else, or what? You see, there's a puzzle. If I claim that the ultimate understanding of the behavior of everything is in terms of the laws of physics, the equations which I'm writing here, and if it also turns out that those equations have a fantastic property, that if I put t equal minus t, you get another solution, then that means that every phenomenon is reversible. And the question is, how does it come about in nature, in the large scale, that it isn't reversible? Obviously, there must be some law, some sneaky fundamental equation. Maybe it's in electricity. Maybe it's in neutrino physics, where it isn't true that if you change the sign of the time, the equation stays the same. Something which drives everything in a certain direction. Let us discuss that question now. We already know one of those laws, and that is a law which says that the entropy is always increasing. If you have a hot thing and a cold thing, the heat goes from hot to cold. So that law of entropy is one. But we expect to understand the law of entropy from the point of view of mechanics. In fact, I did a successful job here of obtaining all the consequences of the argument that heat cannot flow backwards by itself, from just mechanical arguments, and obtained understanding of the second law here. Was it just mechanical arguments? I also used this proposition, but we even tried to deduce, we essentially deduced that much of that proposition by mechanical arguments too. So apparently we can get irreversibility by reversible equations. Let's look into it more closely. Since it has to do with the entropy, our problem probably is to try to find a microscopic description of entropy. You see, if we say we have a certain amount of energy in an object, like a gas, then we can get a microscopic picture of it. You say every atom has a certain energy, added together, that's the total energy. Okay, every atom has a certain entropy, added together, you have that entropy. It doesn't work so well, but let's find out. In order to give an example, calculate the entropy difference between a gas at a certain temperature at one volume and the gas at a certain temperature at another volume at the same temperature. And find out how much, well, I'll let you do it because I'm running out of time and we'll let you work it out. That is, you calculate how much heat has to go in to let it expand from V1 to V2. Divide, since it was at isothermal, you divide by the temperature. And the heat divided by the temperature is the entropy. And if you do it right, it comes out the number of atoms in the gas times k times the logarithm of the final volume over the initial volume. Which, if, for instance, if I expand, I called it 1 and 2. We'll call it initial and final. Huh? If you expand by a factor, the volume by a factor of 2, it's nk log 2, for instance. I want to also consider another interesting example, which is that I have a gas which consists all of one kind of molecule, say neon here and argon here, or white and black molecules. And you start with them this way, and then we ask how much does the entropy change when you move all the molecules so that they're white and black ones all mixed up. There's black and white all mixed up inside the gas. Well, here they were all separate. It's possible to imagine that you have a piston which has holes in it that let the whites through but not the blacks, and another kind of piston that's the other way around. And it is possible to argue what happens when you let the white expand and then the black expand and get to the entropy here, and you get the same formula. Only in this case, say, where the volumes are equal, it would be log 2. So the entropy would nk log 2, which means that the entropy is increased, all right, by k log 2 per molecule. But the 2 has to do with the extra room that the molecule has, which is rather peculiar. It isn't the property of the molecule itself so much as how much room it has to run around in. Now, here's a situation where entropy increases. Energy doesn't change if the temperature is the same, if I compare this system to this system, because every molecule had a certain kinetic energy here, and if they were perfect gases, a certain kinetic energy here, they have the same temperature, have the same energy. Nothing's changed. The only thing that's changed is they're distributed differently. Yet, if left to itself, entropy should increase. And you well know that if left to itself, with all the white molecules here and all the black molecules there, what will happen? Due to the collisions and the jiggling and the banging and so forth, every once in a while, a white one goes toward the black and a black goes toward the white and they bounce. Maybe they go the other way and then they get mixed up. And gradually, the whites worm their way by accident across into the space of blacks. The blacks worm their way by accident. And if you wait long enough, you get to this condition. So left to itself, the entropy would increase. Now we have a simple example of a irreversible process which is completely based on reversible events. What are the reversible events? There's collisions in here. Every time there's a collision between any two molecules, then they go off in a certain direction. Let's say this is a white one, and this is a black one, and this is a white one, and this is a black one. If I took a moving picture of that collision in reverse, there's nothing wrong with the picture. These are perfectly elastic balls, and if they were to come at the opposite, there's something wrong with the picture because they got more energy coming out than in. But aside from that, if the original picture were okay, then the reverse picture would be all right because it's just a fast one, a slow one coming the other way. If I reverse all the arrows, the laws of mechanics and conservation of momentum and energy and so on, just as good. And in fact, it's just as likely one kind of a collision as the other. So it's completely reversible, and yet it's irreversible, because everybody knows that if you started with white and with black, you get a mixture. And you can put this mixture here, and you can sit and look at it, and look at it, and look at it, and it doesn't turn in 15 or 20 minutes into this. And if you start with this in 15 or 20 minutes, well, maybe a little longer, it gets like that, but you can wait for a long time, and it won't go the other way. So see, we have an irreversibility which is based on reversible situations. And the answer is this. We see the reason now. It's that we have this thing in some kind of an arrangement which is in some sense ordered. And due to the chaos of the collisions, it gets disordered. And so it's the change from an ordered arrangement in the chaos of collisions to a disordered arrangement which is the source of the irreversibility. It is true that if I took a backwards motion picture of this and showed it to you, you would watch every collision and you'd suddenly see it, gradually it would work itself into this condition, right? It would go from here to here. And you'd say, that's against the laws of physics. And I say, watch carefully. So you run the movie over again. You look at every molecule. You look at every collision. Everyone is perfect. Everyone is obeying the laws of physics. And it comes to here. And the reason is, of course, that every molecule's velocities are just right so that if the paths are all followed back, they get to here. But that's a very unlikely circumstance to have when you looked at it. You didn't notice that when you first looked at the gas. But it was really all right. The opposite movie requires no special arrangement of the whites and the blacks. They'll always go into this particular way. And if you start with this in no special arrangement, just whites and blacks, it'll never get to here. So we now have to talk about what this disorder is and what this order is. People call it order and disorder, and they sometimes like to say that this is a more probable condition than this, and that entropy is measured by the log of the probability. I don't think that's very good. I think we stick to order and disorder and put quotation marks around it in order to avoid thinking we're talking about order and disorder in the human sense, that this is a pleasant order and that's an unpleasant thing. But it's not a question of that. What is different in these two cases is the following. How many ways, suppose that I would divide the space, all the volume into little elements, little squares, one cubic, whatever it is, millimeter or something. And then I ask, how many different ways, if I had white and black molecules, could I put it in here so it looks like this? There's a certain number of ways. But now I ask, how many different ways can I put the white and black in here so it would look like this, mixed? There are many more ways to arrange than here because, you see, there's no restriction that the whites all have to be on one side. So there are many fewer ways of arranging this than there are of arranging that. And so this is a situation. If we call disorder if we measure disorder by the number of ways that the guts can be arranged so that from the outside it looks the same to you. I mean, you're satisfied. You take it. It's a mixture, okay? So it's just a mixture with more or less even numbers. So I can do that lots of ways. I can arrange the molecule lots of ways. Yeah, that's right. That's the way it is. Yeah, that's the way it is. How many ways can you do that? Many ways. The logarithm of that number is the entropy. And the number of ways here is less, and so the entropy is less, or the disorder is less. So with that technical definition of disorder, we are going to understand the proposition this way. First, that the entropy measures the disorder. Second, the universe always goes, or everything obviously gets mixed up, goes from order to disorder. So that's the reason that the entropy always increases. And I remark, of course, that the order is not order in the sense that you like the arrangement, but order by the number of different ways that you can cook it up and still look about the same from the outside. You see, this case where it reversed on that funny moving picture that ran backwards, there wasn't as much disorder as you thought. You didn't look closely enough, but the reason it did it was because every speed was exactly right. Everything was aimed just right. So that the number of ways you could have arranged it was not as large as you thought. And so that entropy was not so high as you thought when you're thinking of it backwards. Now the next problem is, where does the order come from? If we look around, we have this view that the transformation from order to disorder is the only source of all irreversibility, perhaps. I left not enough time to argue that the laws of electricity, to tell you that the laws of electricity, the laws of quantum mechanics, and all the fundamental laws all have this property of reversibility. We know of no irreversible law. The thing that I didn't leave time for was this, that when I told you the formula for the light field, the electric field, which came from an accelerating charge, it was said in it that you must take the retarded field, which is unsymmetrical. It doesn't say to take the field from the acceleration that's going to happen in 10 seconds, but from the field from the acceleration that did happen. So it looks at first as if the law of electricity is not reversible. Very strangely, however, the laws that this thing belonged to come from a set of equations called Maxwell's equations, which you'll learn about next year, which are in fact reversible. And although I don't have the time to explain it, it's possible to argue that if I were to use always only the advanced wave, the opposite answer, that I say that the field is what's produced by the charge later, but do it absolutely consistently and in an enclosed space where there are black walls all around so nothing is involved from the outside, I can show you that everything happens exactly the same way. An amazing fact, but true. And this apparent irreversibility in electricity, at least in an enclosure, when you have a complete enclosure, is not a reversibility at all. In fact, we have some feeling for that because we know already that when we have an oscillator charge which generates fields which are bounced from the walls and so on, we ultimately get to an equilibrium in which there's no one-sidedness. It just stays in equilibrium. So the fact that the thing looks like it's going by retarded waves is only a convenience in the method of solution. One goes practically nutty trying to think the other way around, but if you think it out consistently enough, you'll find the electricity is reversible also, strangely enough. In fact, as far as we know, all of the fundamental laws, like the Newton's equations, are reversible. Then where does the irreversibility come from? It comes from the order to disorder. But we don't understand it until we know the origin of the order. Why is it that the situations that we find ourselves in are always out of equilibrium, and then it goes into disorder? One possible explanation is the following. Suppose, to make the universe simple, it was just instead of the whole universe, we just talk about this box of gas. In this box of gas, we look at the molecules, and we see, of course, that they are like that. Now, it is possible, if you wait long enough, by accident, by sheer hellishly improbable but possible accident, that the distribution of the molecules get to be mostly white on this side, mostly black on that side, by accident. And after that, as the time of accidents continue, as time goes on, this will get more mixed up again. So one possible explanation of the order is it's just a question of luck. We happen in our universe, let's imagine this represents our universe, to have had a fluctuation in the past, you see, of some kind, in which things got sort of separated, and now they're running back together again. This kind of a theory is not unsymmetrical, because you can ask yourself, what will the situation look like a little bit after this? Just a little bit. A little bit after this, there'll be a wider smear in here of grays, wider than the line in here, because they're getting starting to get mixed up. And what would the thing look like a little bit earlier? The same, because it came from this. And so it got to here by going through an intermediate stage where it was more smeared. So you see, it is symmetrical. So that theory would have the irreversibility, just the accidents of life, I mean the accidents of the universe. I would like to argue that that's not the case, for the following reason. If this were the case, suppose we don't look at the whole box at once, but only look at a piece of the box. Then at a certain moment, all we see, say, is the center. Let's suppose all I see is a little bump on the bottom in the center. And I discover at a certain moment, like now, that there's a certain amount of order in there. There are white molecules and black molecules. What should I deduce about what they'll be in the places that I haven't yet looked? If I'm a believer in fluctuations, if I really believe that this thing arose from a complete mess by a fluctuation, I must take the most likely fluctuation which produces this, not a more unlikely one still. And the most likely condition that things are in, if I notice that this is white and that's black, is that the rest of it is still mixed up. It's certainly less likely that the rest of it has also gotten disentangled. Therefore, one of the predictions from the hypothesis that the world is a fluctuation is this, that if you look at a piece of the world that you've never seen before, you'll find it much more mixed up and not like the piece here. While if you assume, no, when I see this white and black, it's because the past of the universe was really ordered, not due to a fluctuation, but the whole thing is because it used to be white and black, and I can kind of guess that from this pattern. And so I expect, although it does look a little bit smeared here, that perhaps this will continue, that white will be around here, and so on. There'll be order in other places. If the thing were due to a fluctuation, we would not expect the order to be anywhere but where we've just noticed it. If it's not due to a fluctuation, but due to a much higher ordering at the beginning of time, then we would expect to find the ordering in places that we haven't looked. Well, inasmuch as the astronomers, for example, have only looked at some of the stars, and are every day turning their telescope to other stars, and the new stars that they see radiate light and don't suck it in, and they're not mixed up, but they're doing the same thing as the other stars, I conclude that the universe is not a fluctuation, and that the order is something in which, in the conditions in which things started. That the universe, when it started, had a different, had a special condition, which is this, that for the given energy that it had, the entropy was lower than it could be. I mean, it could be much higher than it was. It was an ordered condition. I said that at the beginning when it started. I don't have to say that now that we understand the logic of it. We only have to say at some time. At some time, the universe had a very low entropy for the energy content. Then the entropy increases. Of course, that's the way we say is toward the future. And that's where all of the origin of all of the irreversibility is. That's what makes the processes of growth and decay, that makes us remember the past and not the future. Remember those things which are closer to that moment in the history of the universe when the order was higher than now. And not be able to remember those things where the order is, where the disorder is higher than now, which we call the future. And so I remember once in an early lecture I told you that the remark that the entire universe is in a glass of wine if you look at it closely enough. In that case, it was because the glass of wine is complex. It contains water and glass and light and everything else. But another delight of our subject of physics is that even simple and idealized things, like the ratchet and pawl, if you look at them closely enough and think about them carefully enough, you often are led to realize that the things only work because they only work because they're part of the universe. The ratchet and pawl only works in one direction because it has some ultimate contact with the rest of the universe. If it were in a box and isolated for sufficient time, it would neither go more likely one way or the other. but because we pull up the shades and let the light out, because we cool off on the earth and get heat from the sun, so the ratchets and pulls that we make can turn one way. And this one-wayness is interrelated to the fact that the ratchet is part of the universe. It's part of the universe not only in the sense that it obeys the physical laws of the universe, for as we see that that alone wouldn't account for the irreversibility, the physical laws are reversible. But the main thing, its irreversibility, which is the purpose and the design of the gadget, and it's its most characteristic behavior, its one-way behavior is tied to the one-way behavior of the entire universe and can't be understood until the mystery of the beginnings and the history of the universe are reduced still further from speculation to scientific understanding. Thank you. To the universe. I had life in there too, the question of whether you human beings can reverse the entropy, you know, because we think we make order out of, but I didn't have time to explain why that doesn't work.
Has anybody ever made an attempt to estimate either the age or the predicted life of the universe from the increase of entropy?
No, not in that way directly. The entropy is increasing at a fantastic rate because, you see, when you calculate rates, you can't do it so easily. You have to analyze the details. So that's really the way the age of the universe is argued. How long could the sun shine at the rate that it's shining because of the way the collisions occur and so on? Not merely by saying, well, the entropy is so and so much and the rate of decay of it is so. That's the same thing, really. You just ask, how long would it take? And there are estimates from the ages of the stars and how long it would take, for instance, for the proper motions, you know what those are of the stars? To get mixed up as they are by interacting with each other. If they were all going a certain way and another cloud went this way, they would sort of collide through gravity and they get chaotic. And for instance, in those great clusters, the globular clusters, the stars have gotten into a random condition. And how long will it take to get that way? And so there are various estimates of the age of the universe by looking at a number of situations where equilibrium has been partially approached. And they give different answers, but of the same general order, because the calculations are generally hard. They vary. For instance, the star ages may be, for instance, for the sun, maybe 5 or 6 billion years. But it's very likely that the sun is a secondary star, that some star exploded, made dust, and collected again. That's not the same as the age of the universe, but we don't know. There's clusters. Ages are a little bit longer. There are some ages which come out especially long, but it's probably because the theory of the way the stars are cooking is incorrect. So it's still a difficult subject, but the ages run around 10 billion years.
But nobody's ever attempted to do it directly by means of entropy.
Well, yeah, it is the same. You see, it's not just entropy. You need another thing, which is a rate of change of it with time.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can't go back and find the time. So you need the rate of change with respect to time, and that means you need the mechanisms of everything. You have to watch how long does it take? It's that 1/tau damn thing, which is the hard part in that analysis, that tells the absolute rates, and those things require careful study. So you need to know the collision rates inside the star and what the probability is to make a nuclear reaction and go to a lot of trouble. So this is a hard thing to calculate, and this is what I mean. So there's no direct way by looking so-and-so much entropy, therefore, because you still have to know the rate. And so you must compute it for special circumstances in order to see. For instance, the entropy of the distribution of stars in a globular cluster is known from how irregular are the motions. So how long did it last? So we don't know yet, until we figure out by the number of collisions and so forth, how long it would take to develop that much entropy if it was originally way out of equilibrium, like a couple of streams crossing each other. And you can get an estimate. But you unfortunately have to look into details to get the rates.
One other thing, there's a perpetual motion computer, rather a interesting thermodynamic thing.
Yes, I know that one.
This one.
Oh, yes, I know.
That one?
Yeah, you tell it to your friends and see if you can solve it.
I never could figure out.
All right, I'll leave. I don't like to tell the answers to puzzles as good as that one.
Could you repeat your argument against
yes.
Yes. Against the
what?
The
I didn't say anything about a cyclic theory. I said the idea that the fact that we now find order is the result of a fluctuation. That's not a cyclic theory. That there was in the past, say, a gas like that. We see an order. It's not impossible. You could argue something like the atoms could get this way. Then you say to yourself, well, that happened to be when man was born, and the only reason it happened to be when man was born, because if when it was more chaotic, man couldn't be born. After all, the environment has to be good enough. Mm-hmm. All right. So it's a sort of self-consistent theory, and as a matter of fact, was even for a while supposed to be true by Boltzmann, who first worked out this theory of the meaning of entropy. He believed that the universe was a fluctuation. It can't be maintained for the following reason. If it were a fluctuation like this, I first point out that it's a symmetrical world then. But aside from that, is an interesting point. We don't see the whole universe at once. We only see a piece of it. So let this symbolically represent the piece that we see. And in that piece that we see nice white and black, because we see things are here and other things are there, and it's not in thermal equilibrium. Now what I would like to know is the following. Suppose that you just saw white and black, and you know, I mean, your theory is that the universe came from a fluctuation. The more fluctuation I ask for, the less likely it is to have happened that way. I mean, if I try to get them separated this far, it's very unlikely. It's much more likely that they partly separate and then disappear again. And they partly separate and fluctuate. So if you, in fact, if you look at a little small square which contains seven molecules, the odds that the seven molecules are all white is not impossible. It happens every once in a while. So a tiny area easily comes in for fluctuations. But a bigger area, it takes longer. So therefore, if you take only the area that we've seen and say, all right, that's out of equilibrium, then the most likely condition of the world, if you really believe that it came from this, is the easiest way to get that fluctuation. That is, that's what you mean by the theory that it came from this. And that would imply that the other side, most likely, the rest of the thing is still mixed up. Just like when I see seven white ones here, I'm a nut if I try to conclude that they're all white. So that I would conclude the rest of it is a mess. But it's not true. If you look in places that you haven't seen before, you find things similar to the things that you've seen already. Now that means that the distribution has got an order that extends beyond the region that you've looked at. And that is an order that's related to this. In fact, an order that's related to this just because it came from a greater order. For instance, that there would still be this smearing if I'd only looked, for instance, if I didn't see the smear region in between these two, and only looked here and here, then I would expect that there might be some smear because there might have been some time from the beginning of time. This smear is a memory of this situation, and we get trace memories. We get books that we find from the past, fossils in the ground, and so on. The reason why physicists have gone off so easily on this thing and gotten so they believe that you could have a fluctuation is because there's one, this whole business, the explanation of fossils or book history, you see, things involving history, are things that the physicist doesn't usually deal with. He says, never mind all that, you just send me the experiment and I predict what happens. And it's true, the fluctuation theory of this kind would predict every experiment that's done in an isolated laboratory. But it doesn't predict the most common experience experiment, which is the kind a physicist doesn't do in the laboratory, which is this, like that a geologist does or that an astronomer does. In other words, to look, or a mineralogist does. He sees a certain kind of mineral here. Then he says, I think the way I'm going to understand this is that there were such and such processes, like the heat flowed from the hot CERN to the cool so-and-so, and that precipitated. In other words, he's assuming that it wasn't all there, but it was earlier with heat and cold more separated, and this cooked and so on. And that's going to be very similar over there because it's the same part of the earth. And I dig in there, I ought to find the same kind of structure. And he works. Therefore, his predictions are on a legal basis. I mean, they're a good basis. So there's a kind of prediction that works, which we don't use so much in physics, and I think that's the reason why this has held on as long as it did. I believe it's perfectly clear that the experience of all our colleagues in other fields and common sense tells us that the whole thing isn't a fluctuation.
Unless some astronomical measurements in the near future begin to find more and more.
No, it's already. No, I believe this. I had this idea only about. I had this idea when I prepared the lecture, which was an hour ago. In the meantime, I look outside. I mean, there must be some phenomenon that would have been mixed up by this time that would have worked its way in here, and I would have found out I was wrong. It doesn't take long. It doesn't require astronomy or geology. It's really merely a matter of that your memory works, even. For instance, if you remember that you left a book, it turns out, if you follow it far enough, if you remember that you left a book somewhere and you go and find that book, when you go and look, then it's already a check on the idea that it's not a fluctuation, because the easiest way for you to remember that it's a book, according to this model of fluctuations, is merely that the cells in the head happen to have that fluctuation in them, and not, in addition, that the fluctuation has gone to the trouble of actually putting the book there. No, I'm not. No, I carefully thought this out. No.
How big a region do you have to say? I agree that we won't be...
Only the present knowledge. Only the present knowledge. Only the present knowledge.
No, that isn't right.
That is right. The past is merely traces.
No, if I'm willing to accept that the fluctuation was bigger than I can see just outside...
No, but that's the end, then. Yes, it is, because it's much more unlikely from this theory.
Well, I'm willing to accept a great unlikelihood, an exceedingly great unlikelihood.
Oh, but then you're making this theory unlikely.
It's not an infinite unlikelihood.
But then you're making this theory less and less likely.
But just a minute.
Yeah.
Suppose some finite part of the universe, like our galaxy,
yes,
some huge but finite part,
yes,
of the universe,
yes,
happened to have fluctuated itself into one of these unlikely,
that's,
conditions.
Much more unlikely according to this theory, but wait a minute.
No.
The odds against it are 2 to the minus. Such a fantastic thing that you're not going along with this theory anymore.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I
no,
am.
You're not.
Yes, the probability argument doesn't work because we happen to be born then. Then, of course, the probability is 1 that we're in this situation. Is once you observe it,
all I have to do to understand the present situation by a fluctuation is to understand only what my present idea of the world is.
Yeah, that's right.
And then outside that door, it doesn't...
No, he's looking at a little small...
Well, you think about it a while. Because I thought about it for a long time, and at first I thought that wasn't true.
It's only a question of how big an unlikelihood you're willing to face.
No, but you're not allowed to face any more unlikely... Well, I'm not willing to face any unlikelihood. Yes, but not more than 2 to the minus 156. Is that all right? Well, you're going to make a theory, and already you have an argument against it with probability e to the minus 156 that it's wrong.
Well, I know, but the universe might have been around for an awful long time.
It doesn't have anything to do with it.
Sure.
No, this probability has nothing to do with how long it's been around.
The probability that in the log of gravitation, the exponent is 2. I mean, take a priori all the numbers, it could be 1.
That's got nothing to do with it. That's got nothing to do with it. That's got nothing to do with it. No, that's got nothing to do with it. The reason it has nothing to do with it is because this theory that we're talking about here, this theory of fluctuations, is a theory which associates a probability with every condition of the universe. That's what the theory means, that every condition is more or less likely to occur as e to the minus the entropy. And during the entire history of the universe, the chance that it got to be like it looks now, there's a short intervals of time in which you could have been born, so to speak. Yeah. And so...
Yeah, that's the point. We happen to be looking at the universe during one of those times when we were born.
But there isn't... No, we're only looking at a piece of the universe right now.
I accept your argument, but not to the extent that I will make any conclusion from the fact that there's order outside that door.
Well, we don't know if there's order outside that door yet.
Of course we do.
Well, if you agree that we do, then you're arguing that this is not the situation.
But you haven't lived outside a certain boundary.
That has nothing to do with it.
Of course it does.
I'm sorry. No.
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 No, it's not.
We'll argue with it after 3 days when we both think about it some more. Because it takes some careful thought.
I'm evidently not getting my point across.
I know, but your point is obvious to me. I thought about it a long time. I used to believe it. In fact, I used to extend it. I used to say that the reason that the other stars are emitting light, like the ones that we see, is because it's impossible to get this kind of a fluctuation without having the other things do more or less the same thing. That's just like looking outside the door. We've already looked at the world, and we keep it in our heads, and then we look at it again. Okay. It's like looking outside the door. And I carefully follow the argument through, and I don't agree with it. If you really believe what this theory implies, now you have to understand what the theory is, that the universe started in a chaotic fashion, and that any condition that it's in is as likely as the chance that it would get into that condition from a mixed-up state. And it turns out then that at any moment, and all you have, you think you know the past, but it turns out to be cheaper from the point of view of fluctuation, only to arrange your nerve cells to fool you into that than it is to also arrange the world around you to have the same
cheaper,
fluctuation.
It's more likely. The Earth and the organic chemicals and us living as we are out of chaos?
Yes. Absolutely. It's cheaper than to do it right.
In a less locally ordered situation.
That's right.
Over a larger market.
That's right. Exactly.
Really
exactly.
That's what you're trying to say.
And that's true.
Oh, well, okay.
Because
that,
it's
that
more.
Turns out to be true.
That is true. Yeah, that's the key to it. That's the key to it. That if you see, if.
I don't believe it.
Well, all right. You don't believe it because we're so used.
I don't believe it, that it's less likely.
All right. You think about it, and we'll argue about it some more, because that's the...
produce certain kinds of nuclei.
Yeah, but those things require, from this point of view of entropy, they're in a lot of concentrated energy, which is very hard to arrange from this point of view. We're very used to not taking this point of view. We're so used... Huh?
To make an enzyme.
It is hard, yeah, but it's much harder to make a sun, isn't it? That roaring energy that's pouring out in all directions is a hell of a lot harder than to make an enzyme. It's only 75 atoms that have to be.
Well, I know, but it takes lots of enzymes.
No, but the entropy, you know, is increasing. Yeah. That means only that entropy is really a calculation of the probability from the starting from the assumption that the things were at random. You know the theorem, a priori probabilities are all equal, that nonsense. And then you calculate the entropy of a real situation by comparing it to the odds if probability were. So a measure of entropy is really a measure of this probability that we're talking about in units of K. And so if you want to borrow the slightest excess entropy for the purposes of the thing, if there's anywhere where you want to say in the past there was a better, entropy is a little bit bigger now than it was in the past, you're lost. The moment you propose, the moment you propose to explain something by simply supposing that the entropy was smaller in the past than now, in the usual sense of calculating entropy, what you're saying is that you're going to explain the present by supposing that the past was less likely from this hypothesis than our present is. So you explain the present by assuming a less likely past. And that means you're making, in order to explain something that's more likely, you're assuming something less likely if this hypothesis is right. This is merely my way of a way of saying that this hypothesis is wrong.
It would be easier to create us all in this room and not have the book I left yesterday.
That's right.
With all our memories.
Yeah.
Our memories, everything exactly the way that it is have created us yesterday, and I put the book there and then got here.
That's right. Yes. Because all that time between yesterday and today, the sun has been shining, and that means a terrific amount of entropy transfer, and that mathematically, I mean, it turns out that that's exactly the same. The entropy is merely a method of calculating.
Well, what's the other theory?
That the universe was in the past not disorganized, and it's not a fluctuation. The very theory which you use every day.
That's less improbable.
No, but from this assumption of calculating probabilities, from this assumption about a priori probabilities, it's less probable.
There's some law about the universe we don't know yet.
Yes.
The universe gets created.
It means that this theory is unlikely. That's what it means.
Your theory.
No, you see, in order to calculate
probabilities. You're giving me something more likely, you're giving me something less likely.
On the assumption that you compute probabilities by fluctuations, it's less likely. but it's not necessarily less likely. I mean, you have...
Evidently, this isn't the only way to make it.
Yes, it isn't necessarily from a fluctuation.
Until I see a better way, it's the more likely way.
Well, you already admit a lot...
When do you have just an unlikely...
You yourself admit a more likely way. You said it's much more likely that the book was got there, that the book is going to be there, and that it got there because the sun was there and the earth was there yesterday. So you yourself, assuming that it's more likely that the universe had lower entropy in the past than it would be from the theory of a priori probability.
Of ways in which the universe could have got that.
You may have some difficulty, but you're certainly not going to have a difficulty of the order e to the minus 10 to the 156. That's what.
Because that is a way.
I know that's a way, but that's a ridiculous way because it predicts things which don't check. You can take it if you want, but I'm going downstairs and put this. First, I take this microphone off, and then I'm going to the Athenaeum to eat, and I'll bet you the goddamn thing is there.
The Athenaeum.
Yeah, and your theory is predictable.